the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Quite often in this process, people refer to it as the convention, and perhaps that's for a reason. It has a very central role. But it's not the only response of the international community. In preparing for this, I thought it would be better, it would be more useful for you if I were to talk from that perspective. But I just wanted to underline that that is not the only perspective, because the international community, more broadly, is responding, perhaps slower than it should, but it is now becoming a topic that quite commonly is on the agenda, even when leaders meet bilaterally. Quite often, climate change is one of the things they discuss. And so I just wanted to kind of preface that. I also have to apologize. I'm a man, I'm a male. I really enjoyed the perspective that has been presented here, because it really goes more to the solution side of this issue. What I will be talking to you more is about behavior of governments and how governments work together. But when it comes to the actual solution, many of the challenges of climate change are very central to the way we organize our societies. And so gender is clearly a very important dimension of that. And I also had the privilege of, when I was selected for this job, to be selected by a woman. Unfortunately, she passed away after I joined the secretariat, Joke Wohler-Hunter, but she was keenly interested in these issues. And so I really wanted to kind of underline that this is one of the things that we need to look at. I was wondering, when we were preparing this, they were wondering if I should say something about the science, but I thought that if I was going to be doing that, that would take up too much of the time. And I'm very happy that Arthur has done that. So he has kind of laid the foundation, and perhaps you hear more about the science of climate change than you do about the politics of science and climate change. But still, I think it might be useful to focus our thoughts by looking at this question posed by one of the best scientific minds that we have currently, Steve Hawking. Maybe you've seen this. The first bullet there shows a question that he posed on Yahoo question. He basically threw out this question: in a world that is chaotic, both politically, socially, and environmentally, how can the human race sustain another 100 years? And the moderators of Yahoo, they had to clarify and send out to everyone, yes, this is the real Steve Hawking. This was not just somebody else using that as an alias. And he was quite serious about this. And he got 25,000 responses. So this is a question that resonates very strongly with me. But everybody wanted to know what his answer was. And after a little pressure, he then accepted that. And if you have the time, it's worth listening to. And he clearly and this is the most important characteristic of a scientist, he knows the limits of his knowledge, and he says he doesn't know. But he also added climate change to what he had characterized as the biggest kind of threats to human survival up to this point. Probability of Earth being hit by asteroid and nuclear war. And when he put these things together, it makes me a bit worried, because what can we do about the other two threats? They're all quite distant from an individual can do. But when it comes to climate change, it will not be solved by any one actor alone. It really requires quite a bit of participation in all levels. And so I really want, before continuing, to underline two things. First of all, the question is no longer a question of science. It was for a long time a question of science. And science will continue to have a role. But when when Tony Blair was hosting the meeting of G8, the eight leading industrialized nations, and invited five leading emerging economies to be with them in Glen Eagles in July of last year, science academies of all the G8 countries and three of the invited countries, China, India, and Brazil, got together to send a message to this meeting. This was the first time that science academies had come together, these science academies had come together to say anything. This was the first time that they found, they had the sense of urgency to communicate a message to these leaders. And this is, I'm just taking one sentence out of a longer statement, when they say that the scientific understanding of climate change is now sufficiently clear to justify nations taking prompt action. I'm just taking this as an example, but there are a lot of other, if you look at the science, we have a very successful scientific advisory process through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. You might have heard this acronym, IPCC, a very successful process. So this is no longer a scientific question. I said I wanted to tell you two things. The other one is, how should we respond to this? And I found it quite useful, and I want to share with you how John Hutton is one of the best scientists in this field in the UK. He was one of the chairs of the first assessment of the IPCC. And he describes three responses. And I think it's important, before we move on, to mention these. First one is denial. Second, despair and doom. And as he then characterized the third one, a determination to do something. Denial, of course, is the initial response. But I would say that despair and doom is actually just as unhelpful as denial. And this comes back to this question of, should we be optimistic or not? Because if we fall down into this sense of despair and doom, that has it paralyzes us. And when I say us, I'm thinking of all of us. And so whenever you talk to people about the threats of climate change, please tell them something about what they can do about it. Because if you only tell them, if you only scare them, you only tell them that they really don't have a future, they will turn somewhere else. This is kind of the most important things I wanted to say about the science. And finally, sorry, there's one more point I wanted to make about science. And that is the whole question of how much time is available. And what I'm trying to do here, and I'm not sure if you can read this from the back, it basically has the concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere. It was 280 before the Industrial Revolution. And the range of years during which the emissions would have to peak for us to achieve that level. And if you look at the first one, the 450 ppm, we have that train basically has left the station. It's very difficult to reach that level. But we still, it's still within reach to stabilize at 550. But that means that emissions would have to peak, they would have to start falling again no later than 2030, and let's use 2025 as a. And so it's important to both understand that there is time, but also to understand that time is limited. Okay, no more science. what is the scale of this problem? Is this a technological problem that can be dealt with by natural scientists and engineers in a convention, or is it something bigger? And I would actually say it is quite a bit bigger, and it's bigger than the drafters of the convention understood when they did complete their task just before me. And I would actually say that it is one of our greatest challenges, but it is also, every challenge is also an opportunity. And it's one of the greatest opportunities as well. Because it, most of the solutions, most of the things you do to deal with climate change have ancillary benefits. They are not necessarily, many of them are actually not at cost, but actually having net economic benefit. But it's also a test. They will test mankind's ability to deal with a collective challenge. And it is one of the most, or one of the best examples, and I'm sure Arthur made that point yesterday, of a truly global challenge. And I don't want to develop that concept further, but it really is a test. But I also think, and this maybe is too early to determine, that the solution itself will fundamentally change the way governments cooperate. And this, I'm not saying that has happened yet, but I really want to underline it is a solvable problem. So what is the purpose then of the convention? What was the aim of the convention? And I think it is important to understand that, and I apologize for this long text here, but it is perhaps the most important paragraph of the whole convention. It states the objective of the convention. And the objective of this convention is the stabilization of concentrations. And it doesn't say at what level, but it says it should be stabilized at the level that would prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. Basically, we want to stop before we've done something that would be characterized as dangerous, collectively as mankind. This has been extremely difficult to determine, and because it begs the question then, dangerous for whom? Is it dangerous for somebody living in Switzerland, where I just came from last night, or is it someone in Tuvalu? And there was a minister at the time from Tuvalu for this meeting. He said, when I've read all the documents you have here, there won't be any land to go back to in Tuvalu. And so this question of very fundamental ethical issues. But then it's not just that we should avoid dangerous interference, but also that should be done early enough, quickly enough, to allow sustainable development to proceed. So it's very much a sustainable development focus. There are two dimensions to the response, and I hear that you're familiar with these terms, so maybe I do not need to cover, spend much time on this. These two dimensions of mitigating, trying to prevent the problem. As I put prevention there, the full prevention is not possible anymore. There is climate change that we need to live with, but basically reducing the emissions or removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere into trees or other biospheric aspects. The other one is adaptation, and you heard about that yesterday, I see. And the reason why it's important when we talk about try to understand the international response is that the international response to these two dimensions is fundamentally different. When it comes to mitigation, you are really trying to look at the sources of the problem. And most of the sources historically have come from industrialized countries. You are interested in trying to prevent the development that we're working for to adversely affect the atmosphere or unduly affect the atmosphere. But adaptation is really living with the problem. And it's really very core to the whole development challenge. So, what is this Kyoto thing? Kyoto has been a lot in the news, and not so much good news necessarily, but negative press. It had a lot of negative press, partially because of the delay in its entry into force. The completion of the negotiations was in 97 in Kyoto. It wasn't until 2005 that it was ratified, and or enough countries had ratified it to enter into force. So, but the characteristics of Kyoto, I think, are important for you to understand, and conceptually. And there are a couple of things. One of them is that the most important contribution of Kyoto is to establish targets and timetables for developed countries. And I might use the term Annex 1, which is the list of those industrialized countries, for a period that is now coming up, 2008 and 2012. And just a comment linking to the previous presentation is that Kyoto does not go into how you reduce your emissions. It only looks at the output. It looks at the total emissions of the United Kingdom. It doesn't ask the question, what is the UK government doing about it, only the results of what the UK government is doing about it. And that's a fundamental difference, and this was one of the more contentious issues. Should you basically make national governments accountable, not ask them how they achieved it, but what they achieved. The other thing that is critically important for you to grasp is the fact that it really established innovative market mechanisms. And partially because there is a ceiling on the emissions, as soon as you have a limited resource, you have a value, and that we basically have a new commodity. And that is an interesting commodity in the sense that you're selling an absence of something. Basically, you're selling, what you're trading is the avoided emissions, a ton of carbon dioxide emissions. And this has resulted in a viable, vibrant carbon market with a whole, has everything that the market should have, a market crash, a trade fair where you can gather people, and in Cologne, it's maybe for me at least, I found it was a revelation, interesting for me. They've set up this carbon expo that is always in May before our meetings in Bonn, and they now gather about 1,600 people, more Rolexes and a bit higher dress code than at our meetings. But it really demonstrates that this is a major reality, and it is one of the things that I think will be of value looking into the future of Kyoto. It's over 10 billion turnover in this market, and London is developing itself as a centre for it. I don't have the time to then go into the compliance aspects. That's another very critical innovation in Kyoto, is the compliance regime, and that is now taking shape in Bonn. And this there's one aspect, though, of this carbon market that I wanted to illustrate to you quickly, and that is what is called clean development mechanism. And this was one of the things that emerged at the last moments of Kyoto. They were asking this question, well, we only are putting limits on industrialized countries. How can we incentivize action in developed countries? And that is now an issue that is a big issue looking into the future. And there was this concept of let's make the possibility of having projects in developing countries that do not have commitments. Let's see if we can quantify that, and then allow industrialized countries to use that to meet their commitments. And this is generally referred to as the CDM, Clean Development Mechanism, a very strange name. I can explain to you this came from negotiations. Quite often, a negotiated outcome is not very meaningful necessarily. But it basically is a project-based mechanism where you can reduce emissions if you can quantify it, if you can verify those were additional emission reductions that can then be traded. And one of the reasons I wanted to bring this to your attention is that it has transformed the political dynamics of the climate process. And let me just give you one example. After told you that I'm from Iceland, and because of the alphabet, then I'm sitting next to India. And in the whole negotiations, the primary objective of India was to prevent any inclusion of market mechanisms in the Kyoto process. They are now the leading country in the CDM. And all they talk about now is the CDM. And so this has completely transformed the dynamics of this post-process. Just for illustration purposes, I just wanted to throw up this graph. It basically shows the growth in the number of projects. The first column there is May 2005, just after Kyoto entered into force. The second set of columns, December 2005, and now beginning of this month. And we now have over 1,000 such projects. And if they were all to be realized and the emission reductions achieved, that would give us amount of emissions that is equivalent to the entire emissions of the United Kingdom, Spain, and one small country in addition. So basically, the scale of this is quite significant. And this has really mobilized a lot of action. So this is where we are at the moment. What I wanted to do then is use the remaining minutes to try to give you a little bit of glimpse looking into the future. And here, we're all, in a sense, in a guessing game, because the future negotiations are just starting as we speak. Whereas put there Montreal 2005, this is a shorthand for our conference of the parties, where I saw him first, which he delivered the statement on behalf of NGOs. And this was the largest event, over 10,000 participants. But as it was also the first conference of the parties to the protocol, it launched a conversation on the future in two tracks. One track looking at the Kyoto context, the future commitments of industrialized countries. And here you see this Annex 1 notation. Hard formal process, and a more open, more informal process, which is called the Convention Dialogue on Long-Term Cooperative Action to Address Climate Change. And that's a two-year process that will come to the first step in that was earlier this year, comes to an end next year. The challenge will then be how to bring these two together. And the value of the convention dialogue is that it is non-committal, but it allows the governments to explore the possible foundation, the possible areas for agreement, building consensus. And I just wanted to flag this for you. I don't know if you thought about this, but the international community is not necessarily very good at making decisions and coming to agreements. One of the things that has emerged quite strongly in our process is what I call the value of informality. Informal settings where you allow ministers to exchange ideas, perhaps you let them go through a common experience, like in June, the South Africans hosted such an informal meeting and put all the ministers on top of an elephant. One elephant, but one elephant each. And actually, that reminds me, I'm supporting this dialogue process, and it's facilitated by two co-facilitators, and one of them is from Australia. And he was there, and he told me he's a bit afraid of heights. So when they were lining up to go up on the elephants, he said, well, I'll go for a small one. But he didn't think that, of course, a small elephant also, it's a young elephant. And so it was not quite up to the task, and so he ended up in the bush. Now, this is not just, it's not a small matter, because when you're off the record, and this was done in Greenland last year as well, when you're off the record, you can actually go, you need to make a distinction between positions of governments and concerns of governments. And when they come to the meetings, they speak to their positions, negotiated positions that have been developed in capitals. When you then get them off guard and you talk to them, they talk about their concerns. And that is, but then they also listen to the concerns of others, and that allows them to then build consensus. I want to contrast that with what I call consensus decision making in the UN. And it has very strong limits, because it basically is extremely vulnerable to special interests, because there's no voting. You have to have everybody on board. And in our particular process, this has been extremely effectively used by a special interest group, in this case, fossil fuel exporting countries, particularly Saudi Arabia. And so you quite often end up with the lowest common denominator. So what are the challenges then moving forward? And I mentioned earlier that one of the challenges is to how to maintain the value of the Kyoto-based approach with something that is more inclusive and could work for others. And there's a value in the Kyoto approach, but it cannot be applied to everyone. You cannot ask China to commit, which is going through a dynamic transition process, to commit to output-based targets, but perhaps to an action. And so that is the interesting challenge that we're faced with now, is to combine these two. Also, within the industrialized country family, there's the whole issue of the United States, as well as Australia. Australia has a very different approach to the U.S., but it will not be possible to deal with this process, this challenge, without the U.S. And the only way to get the U.S. on board is to understand where they're coming from and how they approach problems. And it's not just a question of who happens to be in the White House now. And so let's not reduce the issue just to one individual. It's a much more fundamental one, but there's a transformation also within the U.S. on how this problem is conceived. But one of the fundamental missing part in that is the inability of the U.S. system to factor in concerns of other nations. That is very difficult for the United States to do, and that comes out very strongly in the climate area. What I'm saying here also is the different states of economic development among developing countries. It's, of course, in the interest of developing countries to stick together, and they are very good at that in our process, but they are extremely diverse. And within the group of developing countries, we have South Korea, but we also have Lesotho. And Tuvalu and Taiwan, both islands, but they're fundamentally different. I also mentioned that adaptation brings up enormous new challenges that need to be addressed. In a sense, the way forward, in my view, is the whole question of aligning of interest. And there are a lot of possibilities of aligning interests. And I'm just giving you an example. I won't go through all of these examples. One example is the whole possibility of avoiding deforestation and built into that payments for ecosystem services provided by keeping the forest rather than cutting it down. And this is now a very dynamic process within our broader area, and initiated by developing countries. It was brought to Montreal by Papua New Guinea, and a process was established. We had the first meeting of that in Rome 2 weeks ago, and it attracted 150 government delegates, which is very unusual. 68 countries, 46 developing countries. The whole question of fossil fuels, I mentioned special interests, and perhaps gave you a negative impression of Saudi Arabia, but it's also important to realize that fossil fuels will be with us. It's not just a question of renewables. It's also a question of making the use of fossil fuels compatible with climate protection. One way is to capture the CO2 before it enters the atmosphere and store it below ground. Very promising technology. The whole investment challenge for energy. It's been estimated that $17 trillion U.S. dollars will be invested in energy infrastructure. Let's try to influence how that investment spent, and then the whole question of adaptation and how it links to the development challenge. I mentioned in the beginning that UNFCCC is only one actor. Our role, or the role of the Convention, I should say, is very much that of rulemaking, setting the policy frameworks, negotiating futures, but it doesn't go much into, does not at all go into implementation, with the exception of holding the regulatory, having the regulatory roles for the carbon market and those things. There's a lot of roles for the broader UN, and that's where the development issues come in, that's where the gender issues come in, and the Kofi Annan has initiated a process to look at how the UN can be mobilized to deal with climate change. I could tell you about that if you're interested. Business, absolutely key to the solution. And business is now, I would say, 10, 15 years ahead of governments in at looking at this problem. Research and development, both on the problem side and also on the solution side, and then critically important, of course, is civil society. And that is both in terms of, I put here cultivating political will, but I think it's also civil society has a role to play to show the way forward. And so I want to conclude with that. I just wanted to repeat that I'm quite optimistic about this, that we will get through this. I also am quite encouraged to see the signs that I see from inside of the process, but it's very difficult to explain that to a reporter that comes and wants a headline, because those things are not very juicy, and if they try to explain some of the things that are happening behind the scenes, they would not make the evening news. Thank you very much.